Welcome, friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. My name is Kevin Swanson. I'm host of the program, also a father of five, raising our children out here in the eastern plains of Colorado, a safe distance from the demise of Western civilization. And we connect the macro to the micro on this program and distinguish them. The macro's not looking good. However, we think there are some things we can do in the micro. And that's a point we drive home again and again on this program. Let's take a look at the macro for just a moment in terms of the macro socioeconomic status of our country. And America being a key nation, the first domino of the other national dominoes that will go down if the American economy goes down. The American economy goes down, you think that's going to affect Europe, China, Japan? Of course it will. America, a key domino in the entire global economy, friends. And if you look at what's happened over the last 20 years, during the Clinton administration, there was a bit of conservatism that kicked in for just a few years. Believe it or not, the budgets under Clinton between 1998 and 2001 demonstrated a surplus. That doesn't include everything borrowed from the Social Security Fund, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a surplus in the latter part of the 1990s. With George W. Bush, he cranked up the deficit, managing to take it to $430 billion by 2008, and then $1.4 trillion in 2009. And Barack Obama kept it at $1.5 trillion in 2010. And then again, this year, we're looking at a $1.5 trillion deficit. Friends, for the last 3 years, we're looking at a $4.4 trillion deficit altogether, making up just about 30% of the entire national debt. Okay, what I'm doing is I'm adding the deficit of the budgets from 2009, 2010, 2011, 3 years. $4.4 trillion, making up about 30% of the entire national debt. Friends, 222 years of this national republic, and over that period of time, they collected some $11, $12 trillion of debt, and we have added $4.4 trillion in a mere 3 years. Three out of 222 years have contributed about 30% of the national debt that this nation has incurred. Ladies and gentlemen, we have gone asymptotic. That's my conclusion. We have gone asymptotic. We are on the exponent, and we're doing this. Take your hand, sweep it up. Take your hand, sweep it up. It's called the asymptotic increase in the national debt, and it has happened over the last 3 years. Have you ever wondered what it would look like to see the most powerful economy in the world fall? Well, open your eyes, look out the window, and watch what is going on now. And what will be going on for the next decade or two, we are watching a collapse, and this is what it looks like. Now, what will it take to salvage this macro economy? 65-plus baby boomers? The guys retired from the baby boom generation playing golf while the 30-plus young men are playing computer games? So that's your plan. That's what's going to salvage the economy? I don't think so. No. No, you can't have the 65-plus baby boomers, retirees, playing golf while the 30-plus young men who aren't grown up by 30 years of age are playing computer games and not growing up and not contributing much to the economy. Not going to happen. You're not going to salvage the economy that way. Friends, we're at the end game at this point. There are several things that are different about our present age than during the time of the Great Depression. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is our present immigrants come to America and they get a whole bunch of welfare that comes out of the Great Society from the 1960s and on through the welfare programs, the socialized medicines systems that have come piece by piece over the last 20 to 30 years. Immigrants come today for the welfare. Immigrants came 100 years ago for the opportunity. They were entrepreneurs. They were hardworking. They had character. Friends, the immigrants, the status of the immigrants have changed dramatically in just the last 40 to 50 years. We could pay off our debts back during the Great Depression. And, of course, the federal government racked up some debts during the Great Depression and World War II. Yeah, there were some serious debts. But we could pay off our debts because the baby boomers were having kids. Or the people having the baby boomers were having a lot of kids. And the birth rate was 4.0 in excess of that. And the GDP continued to increase. And that made the debt-to-GDP ratio come down substantially over that period of time. Friends, technology was improving over the same period of time as well. We had tremendous technology, the entrepreneurial spirit, the technological potential of the nation was very strong in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, but we've exhausted technology. We have used technology to the utmost in order to create all the mass production, all the technological improvements, all the computerization. We have used up all of that automation, and we are as maxed out on technology as we can get. Yes, they're doing more with computers, but for the most part, it's not improving the efficiency of the technological systems. We're moving all of that offshore. Our computers right now in America are being used to play games. There's little computers that are increasing productivity in our present age. Our greatest billionaires in America today are guys like Mark Zuckerberg, who was on the front page of Time magazine as the man of the year just a few weeks ago. And this guy, okay, this guy hasn't done much for American technology and manufacturing. This guy has created a pastime for hundreds of millions of Americans, and people get on this Facebook and they play around, they communicate and create superficial relationships. That's all this great billionaire has done, and he is, of course, man of the year for Time, because there isn't a whole lot happening in the economy right now. Please understand, not a whole lot happening to improve the economy. Therefore, we're not going to see the kind of improvements we saw in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Now, our birth rates right now are imploding. We're not seeing the huge birth rates that came out of the baby boom generation that created the vast wealth of this nation. Friends, it is people that increase the wealth of a nation and decrease the value of our national debt. And we're not going to see that happen over the next few decades. You can bet your life on that. Ladies and gentlemen, serious changes have happened over a long period of time. Back in the 1930s, you only had 5 to 10%, if that, of the people on government dole. There were a few people getting a little bit of Social Security in the 1930s and 1940s. Today, friends, 53% of Americans are getting a substantial portion of their income from the government. 53%. So you say the character of the nation is still strong enough to come out of this situation. Friends, we came out of the Great Depression. We're not coming out of this depression like we came out of the Great Depression. We don't have the people to do it. We don't have the character to do it. We don't have the technology to do it. We don't have nations willing to lend us the money. We don't have developing nations like China that are as willing to lend us money today as were in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. A lot of things have changed. A lot of water under the bridge over the last several years, friends. So at this point, what do? We pay attention to the micro. I can remember back in 1995, I invited a bunch of my friends over to my house, and I started showing them the debt-to-GDP ratios. I had them all my graphs on overhead projector, and I was showing it in my kitchen, and I was saying, we've got to address this issue right now, and you have got to get out of debt. And I started talking about the debt-free form of life, and people were not listening to this kind of a message in the 1990s as much as they are today. I find today everybody is really tuning into this because they know that if they don't address themselves to the biblical principles relating to debt and family finances, they're going to be in big, big, big trouble in the next 10, 20, 30 years. It's time right now to wake up and hobble back into the Word of God, blow the dust off of it, and figure out what the Word of God has to say about family finances. The macro is going glove, glove, but there's something you can do about the micro. There's hope with the micro, and that's the message that we're going to bring at our Family Economics Conference coming up in North Carolina on March 11th and 12th. But I'm going to talk to Stephen Beck in just a moment on family finances from a biblical perspective. Stephen Beck is speaking at our conference in March in North Carolina. He'll be on with me in just a moment. Stay with me. Maybe you've heard of home education. For the last 25 years, families have been bringing education home as they integrated education back into the family. Now this is spawning a new movement, and it's called family-based economics. Could this movement salvage the family? Could it save an economy or produce a sustainable agriculture? You know, when the debt-based economic systems fail, when the family fails, when the non-sustainable agricultural systems fail, what are you going to do? It's time to get a vision for biblical family-based economics now. The wise man builds his systems on the rock. Now the foolish men didn't, and now look at what's happening. We're taking the 2011 Family Economics Conference to North Carolina on March 11th and 12th, 2011. Invited speakers include Doug Phillips from Vision Forum, Eric Weir from Weir Capital Investments, Scott Brown, and yours truly, Kevin Swanson. We're talking about how you will prepare your children for the future without brick-and-mortar colleges, We're talking about mentorships, contractualization, networking into the changing economies, family dynamics in the integrated economy, family inheritance, bootstrapping entrepreneurism, sustainable family economic systems, and family health care options that avoid socialist medical systems. Folks, almost every developed nation today reports social and economic decline on the macro scale, but we believe that our families can thrive in the midst of it all. We can build gardens in the ashes. For more information, you need to check out conference2011.com now. That's conference2011.com. Welcome back to the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson with you today. And we were talking about family finances, family economy today, and I can't think of anybody better to talk about this than Stephen Beck. He's the author of A Father's Stew, The Biblical Integration of Family, Work, and Ministry. He's a father of three, and his vision is to involve families in their own entrepreneurial endeavors. Stephen Beck, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, you've got an excellent little book that brings all of these issues together in A Father's Stew, Stephen. I think what you're trying to tell us is, man, a father's work is not something separate from the rest of the family economy. We've got to find ways to integrate these things.
That's really so true. In my book, I make the point that we as men have been taught for a long time, even in the church, to compartmentalize our lives, to kind of treat it like a TV dinner, you know, where the mashed potatoes is over in one side and that nasty meat with the gravy is in another side and the little dessert is in yet another side and none of it ever touches one another. And so it's a TV dinner. And I advocate it ought to be more like a stew where the ingredients are mixed. So it's really hard to tell where my work stops and my ministry begins, or my ministry stops and my family begins, or my family stops and my work begins. It's more of a stew. It's more integrated into each other. And I think it also becomes a lot more, let's say, accountable to God when we have all those things flowing into one another and we're able to bring all of that to God instead of trying to compartmentalize our lives.
You know, Stephen, last night my family and I watched a movie called Jean de Florette, an old French movie with English subtitles, but really a powerful message about a family economy that didn't work out very well because a neighbor envied this family. And the story is very interesting, very well put together. It's one of the best movies I've seen in my entire lifetime. But what you see in the movie is this man who comes to this piece of property. He starts raising rabbits and he starts raising crops and he brings his whole family into it and they all pitch in and they're all part of it. And it's just amazing to see a family functioning together, something we don't see very much in a fairly fragmented age. So not only does a father not integrate everything together, but the family itself isn't very integrated in the entire family economy.
That is so true. And you know, I think some people are probably listening to this and they have a 9-to-5 job and they actually go to work, they jump in their car and they drive to the office and they're thinking, wow, that sounds great, it sounds like a little house on the prairie, but how in the world do I implement something like that? And so I've advocated for many years that no matter what you do for a living, whether you're a doctor, lawyer, astronaut, it doesn't matter, you ought to have some kind of small family business on the side. Now, a couple things about that. You honestly don't want this business. It shouldn't be dad's business in the garage because then you're kind of defeating the purpose of having a small family business. But if you can have a small family business, and that can be so many different, and we can talk about some of the different models if you like, but just something where kids are involved. I'll use mine as an example. We started selling some homeschool curriculum, both online and at homeschool book shows. And my children, when they were small, were involved in packing the books into boxes and putting them in the van. They helped man the table while we were at homeschool conventions. As they grew older, they began to, you know, use the credit card machine and enter all the invoices in the computer and give the people their invoices. I mean, by the time they were probably 9, 10, and 11, my wife and I would leave the booth for hours at a time. Usually we were speaking on the stage, And, you know, we'd come back, any problem? No, y'all keep going. We got everything, you know, settled. They didn't like it when Dad came in the booth because, you know, I started answering questions wrong and all kinds of stuff. They ran it just fine without me.
Yeah. Stephen, let's talk to a family out there, maybe somewhat your average American family. They're in a ton of debt. Their spending habits all over the map. They're consuming. None of the kids have really learned to work. And they're 14, 15, 16, 17 years of age, and they don't work. What's wrong with that family? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think we have lost the whole idea of, you know, that I work and then I get paid for my work. I mean, that we've lost the whole idea of, one, we've bought into this system that if I go to school and I get a good degree, then I'll get a good job, and that company will take care of me forever. You know, and honestly, if that was ever true, the 80s just decimated that because all the layoffs, all the bad economy, and now we're in another bad economy that's even decimated that further. So, one, don't trust, an entity, whether it's a corporation or a government or anything, with the lifeblood of your family. Always have something in reserve to be able to take care of yourself. And two, don't let your kids get out of your home without knowing some entrepreneurial skills.
Because
that will keep them in good stead in any kind of economic storm that comes along.
Those children need to learn how to work. And when Dad's away from the home, and when you send your kids off to public schools, or if Mom is so focused on homeschooling all day long, you kind of lose the idea of the family economy. We're supposed to be producing, not just consuming, but producing, and this is difficult for people to get their minds around today. And this is also why I think your 15, 16, 17-year-old kids in the home are not working, because there's nothing to do.
Right.
What do? You know. And one of the things I said is, you do anything. You build birdhouses. You know, build 100 birdhouses. Paint them red. Paint them yellow. Paint them blue. Go door to door. Open up a website. You know, anybody can do that. I mean, a 10-year-old boy could do that, and you could do it in an apartment. Now, the pounding of the nails may be a problem for the guy downstairs, but you can practically do anything.
Well, let me give you a really good example. When I was going to seminary, we were selling a lot of things on eBay as part of our homeschool curriculum, but we started going to garage sales, and we would go, but the problem is we really didn't know the value of things. So we'd go, and I one time I saw this Harley Davidson leather hat. And I thought, wow, that looks like it could sell, but I have no idea. So then we got smart. We took a cell phone to us to garage sales, left someone back at home to research eBay on the fly. We would call back and get, you know, a general idea of what it would cost, and that would allow us to make the purchase or not. Then we would purchase it for pennies, then go sell it on eBay. My son one time bought an old board game that he bought for, I think, a dime, ended up selling it for $150 and some change on eBay. Now, that doesn't happen all the time, but you can bet that he understood a lot about law of limiting returns, law of supply and demand, how to market things, how to take a picture and upload it. He learned so many things from that one transaction. I think that is at least just one way our kids can say, you know what, there are ways to think outside the box, and there are ways that I know that I could support my family in the future if it came to that.
My son was 15 years old. He found an opportunity to buy about 100 computers from a local business for $5 a piece. So he got them all for about $500. They were just trying to get rid of all of them. Of course, he got them all, put them in our basement. They're all over the place. Couldn't walk down there for a couple of weeks. He sold them for $25-$30 a piece and made himself a cool, you know, couple grand. And there's opportunities everywhere. And I think if we train our children to look for these, that will help. Let's talk for a moment about debt. Now, Stephen, because that's a huge issue. It seems to really bind us down. Of course, the Bible says it is a slavery issue. The debtor is servant to the lender. What do you say to a family concerning their family debt?
Yeah, I would say, especially with a business, it is so hard to, I mean, starting a business is not an easy, you know, walk in the park as it is. But if you were to to take your life savings, invest it in a restaurant, get all that kind of debt, I mean, you are putting way too much pressure on a small family business by incurring debt. So don't ever incur debt for a small family business. But even then, you know, I mean, practical tips, pay at least one extra payment a year on your mortgage. If you can swing it, don't get a mortgage. I mean, there's so many ways to go about this. I mean, the Bible is pretty clear. You know, when you look at Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 15 and I would even say Romans 13, you know, the Bible really holds out debt only in the gravest of circumstances. If you look at those verses, you'll see that people really had to be destitute and in pretty terrible poverty to you know, borrow from a neighbor. And even then, the neighbor, the brother, was not allowed to charge him interest. So, you know, I know that that was in the Old Testament, but we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We can bring the principles forward. But I will say one thing that was really going well in Israel. Every 7 years, God commanded them to grant a release of debt.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. Well, you know, they didn't have a lot of 30-year mortgages in Israel. Because who's going to loan somebody a 30-year mortgage when he knew that he had to release that debt in 7 years?
Right.
There might be some 6 3/4 mortgages, but that's about it. So God was very, I guess, cognizant and very concerned to make sure that his children did not fall into the slavery of debt, and he instituted the 7-year you know, release of debt. I would think if churches would take that same posture, we'd be so much better off.
Well, as you know, Stephen, the houses today, the homes today, are much larger than they were back in the early 1900s. If you just go through some of these old neighborhoods, you just drive through an old neighborhood somewhere in some inner city, you're going to find the average home probably 700-800 square feet. And today's homes, twice the size, and here's the kicker, we're in 20 times more household debt adjusted for inflation. I mean, so you've got a tremendous amount, huge increase in household debt, and you're really getting ripped off because you don't have as large of a, I mean, if we had 20 times the size of the house, we'd be happy.
But really?
The houses aren't that large. We're in trouble. We are in trouble, I think, as a nation because we're in so much debt. Part of it is probably due to our greed. So, I mean, should we bring up the G word at this point? You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, our kids, we as kids, baby boomers, we want what it took our parents 30, 40, 50 years to accumulate.
Yeah.
We want it 3 years out of college, and we're willing to put it on the credit card.
Sure.
And I think one of the things that really hits home with conservative Christians and homeschoolers is one of our favorite verses is Proverbs 22:6, right? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the very next verse says, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently part of that training up a child in the way he should go includes some economics lessons,
yes,
some macro and microeconomics lessons, especially about debt, because the rich rules over the poor, the borrower servant to the lender. When you borrow from somebody, you are obligated to them, whether it's a bank, a federal institution, student loans, car payments, whatever. When you borrow, you are not your own. You belong to them in some form or fashion.
Stephen, you bring up the issue of hobbies and pastimes in your book, A Father's Stew. You spent a paragraph or two on it, but a very important issue, I think, because a lot of time and a lot of energy is spent on pastimes in this country today, and you don't see the Pilgrims and Puritans spending a huge amount of time watching baseball games and flipping on the football game. In fact, baseball came in 1846, football in 1892, and rugby in 1750, but not brought over here till later in the 1800s. So you didn't have a lot of pastimes, a lot of hobbies amongst those that came over here and built one of the best nations, one of the strongest nations, one of the most economically blessed nations the world has ever known. So how do pastimes play into our lives? And it seems obvious to me that the average American putting a little bit too much time and expense into it.
You know, that's probably true. I mean, I think we... And part of that is symptomatic that we live for the weekends, meaning we don't enjoy our 9-to-5 job because we don't have a lot of vested interest in it, and we're not building our own you know, legacy, so to speak. We're building somebody else's. Now, I'm not opposed to legacy building. I think God has hardwired men and women to build a legacy and leave something behind. But when you're doing it for a nameless, faceless corporation or someone else, it's hard to be enthused. So you're going to put, let's say, an over, you know, over an exaggerated, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but emphasis on, you know, hobbies. Now, I will say one thing. I think it's very important that we do things with our children. And one of my tips is if you have a hobby, let's say it's golf or shooting or, you know, hiking, try to involve your children in that hobby. You will be amazed that your children tend to like the things that you like if you will involve them. Now, obviously, you're not going to go out and play 18 holes of golf very quickly with a five-year-old, but if you bring them and bring them enough times, I can almost guarantee they will have a love for golf if you treat it the right way and, you know, don't badger them and all that kind of stuff. But then all of a sudden you have a golfing buddy. I did the same thing with shooting. I love to shoot pistols. I've got some property and I shoot a lot. My daughter picked up the shotgun. I became her coach. We shot a lot together and she was a state champion in Texas for shooting shotguns. So I think it's a big principle that don't put down what you're already doing if you have a few hobbies, but incorporate your children into what you're already doing.
How do you achieve a good balance between play and work? And that's a toughie. I realize that takes a lot of wisdom and it's different per family, but give me some principles here. What governs this?
Yeah, that is a good principle. You know, it's funny. I tend to, you know, I'm self-employed. I work from home. I've got a 60-minute commute where I just, you know, walk from my bedroom to my office. So in that regard, it can be a little tough because it's always there. And my wife is integrally involved in my business, so we have to make a conscious effort at the dinner table not to only talk about business because it's a big part of our lives and our kids are involved in our business.
Sure.
And then when my wife and I go out on romantic weekends or evenings, we got to be careful not to always talk about business.
Yes.
So I do think you need other things in your life, but I try to keep not business separate from my life, but I try to keep it under control. And then I try to incorporate ministry opportunities into my business. I try to hire people or work with people that maybe I can disciple. I try to schedule business trips and activities around missions and orphanages. When I go to Costa Rica to speak at a business conference, I always try to hook up with an orphanage down there and do some ministry. So I really try to make my passions, one, that's one thing, try to do your business around a passion, if you can at all do that, and then mix up the ministry with it and mix up the family with it. And I think you will find that hobbies find their own place. It's kind of like sin in a Christian's life. Once they're immersed in the Word and they begin praying, I find that sin tends to fall off like an old coat because there's something so much better.
Well, you read the Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness and all
these
things will be added unto you. If your focus is right on the kingdom of God and that's your passion, then you're not going to be sitting around feeding your own flesh all day long and making
you
the center of your universe and, you know, and on and on and on. You're going to probably find the right balance in some of these areas. If you're seeking the things that matter to God most in everything you do.
I agree totally with that.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're clean out of time, and this is just a little bit of what Stephen's going to share at the Economics Conference coming up March 11th and 12th in Raleigh, North Carolina. More information on that conference, go to conference2011.com. You need to register today for that if you're interested in this area of family economics and renewing, restructuring the micro in the midst of a macro debacle. Well, I think we can do a lot with the micros. We can rebuild micros, and eventually, if we can rebuild enough micros, God will bless the macro. We believe that. But, folks, for more information, for more on what we've just been talking about, you need to get a hold of Stephen Beck's book, A Father's Stew, The Biblical Integration of Family, Work, and Ministry. The book, A Father's Stew, available at kevinswanson.com. Just go to our product page. You can pick it up right there. Again, highly recommended, A Father's Stew, by Stephen Beck. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today on Generations.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And you have been listening to the Generations Radio broadcast. Friends, if you'd like to interact with the program, just email me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. I catch all of those email messages at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for family economies for the next generation.